Chapter 8. One keeps me up half the night, bombarding me with questions I can't answer, about Dr. Zakos's experiments, about what he meant when he said he could successfully download the entirety of one's memories, about what it meant that her body had been so thoroughly well-preserved. "Well, you're still dead," I say. "A little tact, please," she says, laughing. I'm in bed. She's sitting on the floor in the corner of my bedroom. "Sorry," I say. "I'm a bit rattled. Seeing her in the flesh like that, a corpse on a cold steel slab, has upset me more than I'd like her to know. She's been my constant companion for years now, but the sight of her body brought home to me how tenuous her current existence is." "Did you notice?" asks one, jumping right back into her excited speculation. "There were at least 10 tiles on that wall. Remember what that Arsis kid said in those chats? About humans being dredged for intel? You think they're being kept preserved on those slabs, too?" I marvel at one's mind. She wasn't even present until I finished reading Arsis's IM transcripts, and she was definitely gone when I was in Zakos's lab. She clocks my amazed look. "What?" she says. "You already know your mind's an open book to me. Just because I'm gone when stuff happens doesn't mean I can't see it once I come back." And without skipping a beat, she returns to her obsession. "Anyhow, if I've been so well preserved, that means we can probably jack into each other again somehow and kickstart my memories inside you. I mean, I know I'm pretty, but I don't think Dr. Zakos has been preserving me for my looks. He must have been doing it to keep the stuff inside my brain, like, fresh." She nods, pleased with her reasoning. "We need to get back into that lab." I look away from her. "One, what I need is to get some sleep. It's the middle of the night, and I have to be at the media facility in 4 hours. One is silent. "If I screw up at work, I'm as good as dead. And if I'm dead, you're dead. And this whole lab plan will be moot anyway. Okay?" I turn back to One, but she's gone. It occurs to me that I'll never know when one of her disappearances is her last. One day, she'll blink out, just like this, and I'll wait for her to reappear. But she won't. For all I know, I just saw her for the last time. I force my face deep into my pillow and try to sleep. I arrive at my console the next morning, groggy and bleary-eyed, dreading the next 12 hours. I take my seat next to Serkova and dive into the data stream. Despite my fuzzy head, I pull a decent rank after my first hour. But with exhaustion creeping up on me, I can feel my productivity beginning to slip. By the 15-minute mark of the next hour, I know I'm headed back to the bottom of the pack. So, I come up with a little trick. For every 5 or so sources I legitimately review, I automatically throw another one in the discard directory. I know my provisional accuracy percentage will take a hit, but from what I can tell, it carries a relatively low weight on overall ranking compared to discard and investigate totals. Using this technique, I've climbed all the way to number 6 by the next hourly rankings, with 73 discards and 17 investigates. My provisional accuracy is 73%, lower than the hour before, but not bad enough to raise any red flags. I can feel Serkova sneering at me. I don't bother to hide my smile. I pass the day like this, racing against Serkova. Giving up on finding time for research, I use the task in front of me to distract myself from everything. From One's perilous condition, from Zakos's strange work in the lab, from my hateful father, from what the work I've been doing even means. My only goal is to get ahead of Serkova in at least one hourly ranking. My last rank of the day is number 2, right ahead of Serkova at 3. "Better luck tomorrow, Serkova," I say, wearing a bright, fake-friendly smile. He curses me and heads out of the lab. After work, I head upstairs to my room to wash up before dinner. My mother told me Kelly's skipping dinner again for her after-school program in the nursery. Yeah, right. I know the real reason. She doesn't want to share a table with me. But not even that can get me down. Beating Serkova, even just the once, was too big a victory. I find myself racing up the stairs to my room, 3 steps at a time. I open the door to my room, hoping to find one. I can't wait to crow to her about kicking Serkova's ass. When I enter, I see her feet peeking out from behind the corner of the bed. One? I step closer. She's flat on her back on the carpet, mouth and eyes open. She looks glazed, and her skin is doing that milky flickering thing that it did back under the baobab tree, only much, much worse. What happened? I crouch beside her on the floor. She's silent. One? After a moment's silence, she speaks. Nothing. Her lips barely move, and her voice is raspy. It's just that each time it's darker than the last time. It hurts more. It's more obliterating. Her eyes swim around in her head, searching for me. Her gaze finally finds mine. It's like what's blacker than black, you know? Yeah, I say. But I don't know. She's going through something I have no experience with. She's going through the end. I hear my mother call me for dinner. I turn back to one. I'm going to stay with you. She shakes her head, almost imperceptibly. No, she says. You should go. Her eyes drift back to the ceiling as she lies there, flickering in and out of view. Heartbroken, I leave. My father joins my mother and me for dinner. He barely speaks, except to ask my mother for seconds. He has a true warrior's appetite, and to give us an update on Ivan.
His superior officer says Ivan is doing excellent work. Says he has the makings of a general himself.
That's wonderful, says my mother, beaming approvingly. Does he know the good news about Adamus?
My father and I exchange a quick, uneasy glance. The general wipes his mouth with a napkin.
No.
Why not? She says, looking back and forth between the two of us. I think he'd be happy to hear his brother is alive.
Adamus is not Ivanek's brother,
my father says, silencing her. Technically, that's true. I'm their biological son, and Ivanek was adopted, raised by my parents. But I catch the general subtext. Saying I am not Ivanek's brother is my father's way of saying that I am unworthy of being honored that way, that I am less their son than even Ivan. My father steps into the kitchen, leaving me and my mother alone in awkward silence. The truth is, I'm too upset about one's worsening fades to even care about the hateful soap opera of my family life.
You've barely touched your plate, Adamus.
My mother looks at me with concern.
Is something upsetting you?
The question is so ridiculous, given the circumstances, I almost laugh. I almost say, yes, mother, everything is upsetting me. But I bite my tongue. I hear one's voice from last night.
We need to get back in that lab.
She's right. She's fading so fast, I need to convince Dr. Zakos to try the procedure again if she's going to have any hope of living. But how can I convince my father to let me go, to grant me leave of my temporary position in the surveillance facility?
Adamus?
I'm just afraid, I say. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I see it, the dim outline of a new card to play.
Afraid? My mother asks. Afraid of what?
Of father. I'm afraid he'll make me... My voice trails off dramatically. I force myself to look as stricken, as ghostly with fear, as I can.
What are you saying?
And then I blurt it out. I explain to my mother that I ran into Dr. Anu's replacement in the Northwest Tunnel the other day, and he said that he could do the mind transfer procedure again. He says it'll work this time, that they can't do it to just anyone, it has to be me.
And I'm afraid. I don't want to go back into the labs and be hooked up to machines. I'm afraid I'll go into another coma, or worse. I will tears to my eyes. He says he can dig up real information about the guard if they do it, and I think the general will make me... Oh, Adamus, I doubt that. I interrupt her, louder than before. But he will! If the general finds out, I'm sure he will! Then I hear his low, deep voice coming from behind me.
If he finds out what, exactly?
It's the general, taking my bait. Chapter 9.
Have a seat, get comfortable.
Dr. Zachos has positioned a large, curved chair in the center of the room and gestures for me to get in. Nervously, I take a seat.
I was delighted to hear from your father last night, he says,
flitting around the laboratory, putting monitors in place, booting up scary-looking medical equipment.
But with the short notice, it might take me a while to get this equipment up and running.
I can tell he's ecstatic to use the equipment on me. Adamus, the Mogadorian lab rat. I sink into the chair, trying to get comfortable, while Zachos sets up. I should be happy. My ruse worked. I deliberately let my father overhear that I didn't want to be used in Zachos's mind transfer experiments, and he had Zachos on the phone within minutes, giving him the go-ahead to plug my brain into one's corpse. The general still hates me, and seeing me weak and afraid, as I'd pretended to be at the dinner table, gave his meager conscience whatever license it needed to risk my life again in the lab. The general is free to hate me. I hate him too. And now that I've succeeded in tricking him again, my hatred has a new depth, a new dimension. Contempt. I fooled him. The machines begin to whir. I'm afraid of what will happen while I'm under. But push that aside. More than anything else, I'm relieved to know that one may have a chance of survival. If the technology has improved, maybe I can get through the procedure unharmed, rescuing one in the process.
The transfer rig will take about 20 minutes to warm up, Zachos announces.
I nod as I watch the doctor approach the steel console beside the tile containing one's body. He presses a few buttons, and the slab comes out with the same hydraulic whoosh as before. From where I'm sitting, I can't see one's body. Zachos presses a few buttons on the edge of one slab, then presses the console again. The slab whooshes shut. You don't need... I start, then catch myself before I call her one. You don't need to connect the body to me?
No,
he says, with professional pride.
All of the containment pods are linked to this mainframe terminal, he says,
pointing at the largest monitor.
Everything besides the pods' hydraulics are controlled through here. Brain scans, vitals, preservation protocols.
Do you have other bodies in there? I ask.
Yes, he says. Quite a few. Some of them are unaffiliated mortals I've used for experimentation. The rest of them are greeters.
Zachos, oblivious to the fact that I'm a traitor to the Mogadorian cause, explains to me that when the Lorik were first scouting for a planet where they could hide from the Mogadorians, they made contact with a few scattered mortals. The Mogadorians captured these humans almost 10 years ago and subjected them to a series of interrogations. However, Mogadorians knew next to nothing about Earthling psychology or behavior back then, and, at that point, our interrogation techniques were quite crude. Some of these greeters caved to Mogadorian interrogation, but it was quickly discovered the intel they have about the Lorik's locations. What they told the greeters upon contact was often faulty. Because of this, my people began an ongoing research endeavor that used complex brain mapping technology to find a more accurate means of extracting information. In other words, rather than asking for it, we tried to find a way to take it.
And as a matter of fact, Anu's experiment with you was an offshoot of that research. Unfortunately, it failed, but I was intrigued.
The procedure you are about to undergo represents a massive refinement of his work.
I can tell that Zachos thinks this little history lesson is complete, but I want to know more. And you've kept these greeters alive this whole time? Zachos gives a breezy laugh.
Not exactly. We've raked their brains so thoroughly trying to extract information about the guard that all but one of them have perished. Of course we're keeping the others preserved, should our technology advance to the point—
Who lived? I ask, interrupting him, steering him back to information I know one will want, should both of us survive the procedure. Dr. Zachos looks at me silently for a moment. For a second, I worry that I've raised his suspicions. Instead, he impishly raises an eyebrow.
Want to see?
He dashes over to a panel next to another tile and opens the containment pod. After the mist clears, I crane my neck to get a better look. I see a handsome, solidly built middle-aged man. His skin is shockingly white from being in containment for so long. It's practically the color of vat-borne skin, but otherwise he looks healthy. His eyes are closed.
Just one moment, Zachos says, pressing a few buttons inside the pod.
Then Zachos leans over the man.
Malcolm Good,
he says, addressing him gently, like a normal human doctor addressing a normal human patient.
How's it going in there?
Malcolm Good opens his eyes. I feel a chill, a wave of nauseating pity for this poor human, trapped in a cold box for years on end. Hello, he says, looking up at Dr. Zachos with an expression of utter guilelessness and trust. It's like he has no idea how much time has passed, or what he's been subjected to. I seem to have forgotten where I am, he says, smiling innocently. Could you tell me where I am? Dr. Zachos only chuckles in response.
Well, he says, addressing me. You get the idea.
And with that, he reaches over to the panel, presses a few more buttons, and Malcolm is prompted, whether by wire or chemical, to return to sleep, but not before he fixes me with a haunted, quizzical look. I'm under. At first, it's just a void. A black, so black. I wonder for a moment if this is what one experiences when she disappears. Then come blasts of light and crackling static, as I find myself plunged into one's memories. I look around, getting my bearings. I'm in a wooden shack, in bed, my head hanging over the side of the mattress. Through the cracks in the floorboards, I see rushing water. A river. The Rajong River.
They're coming!
I turn to see Hilda, one's Sepan. She's staring through a slat in the door, ready to fight. She rushes to me, shaking me, pulling me out of bed. That's when I realize I'm not just a spectator to one's final memories, as I was during most of my time in her consciousness. I've been plugged directly into her experience. Ghost One is nowhere to be seen. I'm completely fused with her, every thought, every feeling. The humidity inside the shack, the sweat trickling down my back. I can feel Hilda's eyes on me, inspecting my readiness for combat. I'm not ready, I think. I'm just scared. The Mogadorian assault team kicks in the door, and Hilda leaps into action. She dodges a Mog's knife, and as the Mog spins around to recover his balance, she crushes his windpipe with a single strike. As he collapses, she whirls to another Mog, swiftly snapping his neck. I'm too paralyzed with fear to move. I know what's coming. Hilda is about to die. My heart screams. I love this woman with all of one's love. Another Mogadorian attacks. Hilda flips him onto his back. But this Mog is quicker than the others. He unholsters his blaster and shoots Hilda right in her chest. Everything goes red. all of one's anger, shock, and rage at the loss of her Sepan. My Sepan floods my system. No, she can't. They couldn't. It's my fault. I failed. How could I? These are one's thoughts, but I feel them, hear them, as my own. I want her back. I want her back. No, no, no. Must pay someone. Must pay. They must pay. Our combined fury rises. They will pay. Yes, they will pay. We will make them pay. And that's when I feel it. Something ripping open inside of me. Something so entirely new, yet so strangely familiar that it's almost funny I never noticed it before, that it took this crisis for me to notice it. The floor starts to shake, a massive rumble coming from beneath my feet, but also coming from inside me. And as my heart sings, yes, they will pay, they will pay, everything goes black, and shadows, hands waving in front of my face, fluorescent light burning through the dark. I am back in Zakos's lab. He's cursing, ripping electrodes from my head, adjusting the console I'm plugged into. What happened? I ask. I'm still buzzing from what I've just experienced. As chaotic as the memory transfer was, as turbulent as it felt, there was something I was on the verge of understanding inside it, a promise of something great. But now that I'm back, it's gone.
Your vitals were spiking faster than I had anticipated. If I'd kept going...
He lets out another string of curses. I sit up in my chair. He stares at me.
Are you able to recall anything? Do you have any usable intel I can send up the chain?
I shake my head. Of course I'm lying. Beyond what I just experienced, I already have an intimate knowledge of Lorik's psychology, the relationship between the guard and their Sepan. I have the entirety of one's history burned into my brain. I've had that ever since the first transfer. He levels me with his stare. He's evidently flustered, his hair damp with sweat, but that doesn't make him any less scary.
I know it's in there, he says.
I feel a chill at his words.
You may not remember it consciously, but I know it's there, in your brain. And I know that I could get it, he says.
The way he speaks, it's like he's talking to himself.
Our understanding of Mogadorian physiology is well beyond what we understand about Lorik or mortals. With my neurological mapping techniques, I could do what Anu couldn't. Run those currents three times as hard, and rip that intel straight from your brain and onto my hard drive.
He stares at me. I feel weirdly exposed, objectified, like a slab of meat at a butcher shop.
But for that, he says, chuckling bitterly, I'd need your father's permission to kill you.
Chapter 10. I'm dismissed to finish out my day at the surveillance facility. I have no fight left in me, and my rankings take a nosedive. 16, 18, 18, 20. Last place. I know Dr. Zakos immediately reported the experiment's failure to my father, but I doubt he took the risk of pitching his idea of mentally vivisecting me to the general. I have two more days left in the lab before my father decides if my results qualify me for survival. Either he will have me executed, or he will deem me an asset to the cause and allow me to continue working as a surveyor. Oh, joy! After the lab, it's another miserable dinner. The general is busy down in his briefing room, so it's just my mother and Kelly. Kelly refuses to even look at me. When my mother goes to the kitchen, I turn to her, try to start a conversation. We haven't been close since before the mind transfer, almost 5 years ago. I wonder if she can even remember back then, when she hated Ivan for teasing her and roughhousing with her, and seemed to adore me, her gentle older brother. "Haven't seen you in the tunnels," I say. "How are things going in the nursery?" She is silent, slowly chewing her food and staring straight ahead. It's hard to believe a 14-year-old girl could be so full of such a steely hatred. Kelly, I'm sorry if it's embarrassing that I survived, that you have to explain that your loser brother has come back.
Ivanik told me, she says, hissing at me suddenly. He told me the truth about you. I know what Mom doesn't. You're a traitor.
My stomach does a somersault. I feel like I could throw up my entire dinner.
So you can pretty much stop trying to make up with me. It's not going to happen.
She gets up from the table.
I wish you were dead,
she says, before running up the stairs to her room and slamming the door shut. Good night to you too, I say, laughing miserably to myself. After dinner, I go up to my room. One isn't there. I haven't seen her since last night. Somehow, this doesn't surprise me. The mind transfer was so fast and so quickly aborted that I doubt it did much to reestablish her foothold in my consciousness. Perhaps that's the thing I felt like I was on the verge of understanding. How to keep her alive inside of me. It's funny to think Zakos thought he was covering his ass with the general by protecting my life. If Zakos had killed me, my father probably would have given him a medal. I have nothing to stay up for. I go to bed early. Sleepless in bed, I consider the pitiful irony of my current situation. I came back here to rescue my one and only friend in the world, yet I failed to save her, just as I failed to save Hanu. If she isn't gone for good, she will be soon enough, and now I'm stuck here, trapped, alone. A desultory day at work. I'm pulling in rankings in the 13 to 15 range. Pathetic. I've scaled back on my discard trick. Why bother trying to impress anyone with my rankings anyway? So I actually investigate each link that's fed to my monitor, even though it damages my productivity. At least it's more interesting than mindlessly shutting the leads into one folder or another. I click on a link. This one leads to a forum dedicated to readers of some publication called They Walk Among Us. The Mogadorian mainframe has isolated a thread titled Next Issue, posted by a user TWAUFAN182. A threaded dialogue unfolds when I click on it. Please, I've read TWAU number 3 so many times. Please tell me when Next Ish will come out. Thanks. Happy face. TWAUFAN182. Sorry, TWAUFAN. No plans for issue number 4 yet, but be assured we have plenty material for one. Thanks for reading. Admin. What? What material? You can't leave us hanging like that. Spill it. TWAUFAN182. Come on, man, give us a hint. TWAUFAN182. It's been weeks with no updates. This forum is dead. R.I.P. L.O.L. TWAUFAN182. That exchange was dated a year ago. Then, this morning. Sorry, been busy. We've made contact. Definitely extraterrestrial. True Mog in captivity. Admin. I almost gasp. There are humans out there who have captured a Mogadorian? Or who at least think they've captured a Mogadorian? I know at once that this is the first link that's passed through my monitor that's truly worthy of an EHP ranking. I click on the hyperlink and drag it over to the Investigate directory. But then I stop. Why would I alert the Mogadorians to the location of these humans? Humans the Mogs will undoubtedly capture and kill. I might get in trouble if I discard the link. Surely there are fail-safes built into the system for erroneous discards. But why should I make it easier for these Mogadorian bastards? By discarding this link, I will save a human life. Or at least slow down the Mogadorian hunting machine for a few minutes. It's worth it. I don't care if I live or die. If one is gone and I'm stuck in this vile society, why should I fight to live?
The pleasure of outperforming Serkova has faded. Besides, with rankings like my current ones, that ship has sailed. I click discard. They'll come for you. In my bones, I know I'm going to reap hell for what I've done, and I don't care. Fuck the Mogadorians. I start dumping every link on my monitor into the discard directory as fast as I can. There's no upper limit on the number of links that can get routed to a single monitor. The more links you process, the more get routed your way. So before I know it, I've chucked upwards of 300 links into the discard directory. I'm making a spectacular mess of their system. The clock counts down to the end of the hour. How many unevaluated discards can I cram into the directory before my fellow surveyors catch on? For that matter, how long until my treasonous evidence burying gets discovered? I'm exhilarated. The hourly rankings come in. I've discarded 611 links. Investigated 0. My provisional accuracy ranking is a hilarious 11%. Better yet, as if to make a mockery of their entire ranking algorithm, I come in first place. What the hell, Atomos? Serkova snarls at me. The others turn around to face me, all the work in the surveyor facility grinding to a halt. No one knows how to react to my total breakdown. Are you friggin' nuts? I smile at Serkova, dizzy from my own outlandish behavior. Yeah, I think I might be. Then an alarm goes off. I hear the heavy march of footsteps coming down the hall, soldiers dispatched from HQ. You deserve whatever you get, says Serkova, spitting at me. I run. I dodge out into the northwest tunnel to see the soldiers coming, fronted by the general. They look pissed. If I'm going out, I'm going out with a bang. I run towards the marching guards, then pull to a stop in front of Zakos's lab. Hey, Pops, I say, taunting the general. Did I do something wrong?
You know what you've done,
he sneers at me. He gestures to the guards to seize me. I resist, swinging my arms wildly, shouting as loud as I can. The Mogadorians hardly know how to react to such an undignified resistance. I can feel my father cringing in embarrassment. The guards manage to subdue me, but the ruckus has attracted Dr. Zakos's attention. He steps out into the hall as the guards begin dragging me away, probably to feed me to some hungry piken. For a moment, I worry my plan has failed, but then I hear Zakos's voice calling from down the hall.
General, wait!
My father halts our progress to listen to what Zakos has to say.
If I may be so bold, I may be able to put your son's life to some use.
Chapter 11. I'm back in the chair. Zakos has convinced my father to allow him to perform an accelerated mind transfer between me and One. The process will be so intense, it will kill me, literally frying my brain. But Zakos has guaranteed the general that he will be able to download the contents of One's transferred memories from my brain after my death.
If your son has been such a disappointment in life, at least allow him to be of service in death.
Zakos assured the general that even if the intelligence he extracts from my brain is of little consequence, the results of the experiment will represent a tremendous leap forward for Mogadorian technology. You don't need to make a hard sell, Zakos, I said, still trapped in the guard's grip. I turned to my father, an impudent smile on my lips. Isn't that right, Pops? He had you on board at Kil Adamus, didn't he? The general didn't even look at me. He nodded at his guards, who released me, then turned to the doctor.
Have the results on my desk by tomorrow morning, he said.
I've been in the lab since. Guards monitor the door, but I'm not bound or watched by anyone but Zakos. Where am I going to go? How can I possibly escape? As my little demonstration in the hallway proved, I'm no match against Mogadorian soldiers. Neither my father nor my sister has seen fit to visit me in my final hours, but my mother ventured down to deliver me a last meal. She entered the lab a few hours ago, carrying a couple slices of fresh baked bread wrapped in a napkin and a plastic container filled with soup.
She hesitated for a moment, looking for a suitable place to lay the meal. Then, realizing there was no good place for it, she wordlessly put the bread and soup on a laboratory counter. Then she turned her back to me, her hand on the door. "Is it true?" she asked.
"Is what true?"
I asked, a bit spitefully. I wanted to make her spell it out.
"That you've betrayed the Mogadorian cause?"
I guess my father figured we were past sugarcoating things, and had told her everything.
"Yes," I said.
Without another word, she left. Moments later, as I held the still warm bread in my hand, I realized that final home-cooked meal would be the last kind and motherly thing she would ever do for me. I threw it in the trash. Now Zakos is prepping me for the procedure. He's filled a syringe with some kind of anesthetic, explaining that this time he will render me unconscious before the procedure begins, which should give him greater precision over the neurological mapping. Soon, I will be put under, then I will join one in her memories, and then I will be dead. Zakos opens one's pod to make a couple of adjustments before the procedure begins. I think of one and all the greeters in their pods.
"Does it hurt?" I ask.
"Excuse me?"
He's absorbed in his preparations.
"What you did to all the greeters, keeping them alive, raking their brains for intel all those years."
"Oh, I never really thought about it," he says. "Yes, I would guess it's quite excruciating."
Just then I hear her voice.
"You're not really going to let him get away with that, are you?"
I turn to see one, flickering beside my chair. I had wondered if I would get to see her again before going under, if she hadn't already flickered out of existence. "I don't really have a choice," I say. "I'm trapped here."
She leans against the counter. "You always have a choice. You had a choice to screw up today on the job, to bait your father into sentencing you to death, to do it in Zakos' earshot so you'd end up here."
"I was afraid you were already gone. I couldn't think of anything else. I ran out of hope. I figured I was going to lose you anyway, and we could at least see each other one last time," she says, finishing my thought. She gives me a flirty, cockeyed grin.
"That's sweet," she says. "But that wasn't the real reason you went haywire today."
She's right. That isn't how all this started. In the moment, I just couldn't bring myself to rat out those humans to my people. That was the first time the work I was doing as a surveyor was clearly going to help the Mogs and hurt others, and I couldn't do it. Over the past week, I've had to take some crazy, on-the-fly risks, but that was the first time I acted completely without a plan, without any clear sense of what the consequences would be.
"One," I say, "I don't even really understand why I did what I did."
She doesn't answer me immediately, but instead turns back to the tiled wall, crossing her arms. I can see an idea brewing in her head. After a moment, she turns back to me and fixes me with a cryptic stare.
"Don't worry, Adam," she says. "You will. Seeing as you're going out anyway," she says, leaning close to my ear. "Don't you want to go out swinging?"
I look at her confused.
"A giant leap for Mogadorian technology," she whispers, casting a glance over at the tiles where the greeters' bodies are kept. "Is that what you really want your legacy to be?" It's time. I'm in the chair, connected to Zakos' console by a bunch of wires and cables. The machine that will plug me back into one's consciousness is already humming.
"The parameters are in place," Zakos says. "It will just take a moment after we administer the anesthetic to begin working."
He gestures to a syringe on a tray of tools next to me. The syringe hasn't escaped my attention either, though. He approaches, towering above me in my reclined seat. As he holds my left hand against the arm of the chair and begins to pull the strap over my wrist, I know I have only a second to act. I jerk my hand loose from Zakos' grip and leap up, grabbing the syringe and stabbing it into Zakos's throat before he can make another move. He punches me desperately, making contact with my face. But it's too late. I've already depressed the plunger.
He staggers back in a woozy daze, the drugs already making their way into his system, and falls to the floor.
I rip the strap off my left hand and stand up.
"Why," he says, puzzled at what I've done. "What could you possibly hope to accomplish?"
Then, he's out. I rush to the lab's door, and, as quietly as possible, lock it from the inside. I'm lucky that Dr. Zakos didn't knock anything over on his way to the ground. Any noise would have attracted the attention of the guards on the other side of the door. But I know that once I do what I'm about to, alarms will sound, getting their attention. It won't take them long to override the lock. But that's okay. I only need a little time. I run to the steel panel controlling the containment pods. There are no buttons, no instructions. I have no idea how to imitate Dr. Zakos's complex gestures.
"Let me," I hear. One's voice. She takes over my movements, just as she did when she hijacked my body in the jungle. I'm a spectator to my own body, watching as my hand dances elegantly across the surface of the panel. An alarm goes off. I feel one vacating my body, ceding control back to me. I get back in the chair, reattach a couple of electrodes, and grip the arms of the seat. I turn for one last look at the wall behind me, as all of the containment pods open noisily at once, a hydraulic chorus disgorging their captive corpses, all except one's pod, which is still linked to me through the mainframe. Exposed to open air, the corpses will be rendered useless to further Mogadorian experimentation within minutes. It's hardly an elegant sabotage, but it will keep the Mogadorians from getting any intel from the dead greeters and should set Zakos's research back a few years. The machine connecting me to one begins to thrum louder. I used up all the anesthetic to knock Zakos out, so I expect this will hurt. But I know that one has a plan for me, and it doesn't involve dying. That's when I see Malcolm Good, waking up on his slab. "One?" I ask nervously. In the heat of the moment, I hadn't even considered what would happen to Malcolm, the sole surviving greeter. I watch as he pulls himself loose from his connecting cables and steps off his slab. His legs, unused for years, instantly give out on him. He locks eyes with me. He's almost 3 times my age, but he looks as lost and confused as a child. One's voice in my ear. "Don't worry about him. He's going to be fine." That's when the pain hits. I'm plunged back into the moment of Hilda's death, the blast of the Mogadorian's gun opening up her chest right in front of my eyes. Hilda falls to her knees before me. Red, orange, and purple swarms my vision. Everything's faster, louder than before, pulsing and buzzing. One's thoughts are screaming in my head again. "No, she can't. They couldn't. It's my fault. I failed. How could I? They will pay. We'll make them pay." I feel it again, that ripping sensation inside me. Oh, right. That's right. That's how. So simple. The floor starts to shake, a massive rumble coming from beneath my feet, but also coming from inside me. And as my heart sings, "Yes, they will pay. They will pay," the walls of the shack begin to shake, and I stomp my foot. A wave of energy shoots through the floor. It's a power greater than any I've ever wielded, and it's coursing through us and rippling outwards. Through the orangey blur of my vision, I see the walls of the shack explode. I see 4 Mogadorian warriors flung out of sight by the force that's come from within me. As the dust settles, I look down at my hands, at my legs. I expect to see one's body as the source of this power. But I don't see one's body. I only see my own. "That's it," I hear. One's voice. I turn around, surprised to discover I am no longer in the Malaysian shack. I am on that beautiful California beach. Our place. One sits on the sand, waiting for me. "Pretty cool, huh?" I nod,
flabbergasted at the sheer power of one's legacy. I'm dizzy from wielding it. Come sit with me. We don't have much time. I collapse beside her, still breathless. It's perfect. The sun is warm on my skin, the sand cool on my feet, and best of all, one's here, right by my side. Across the sea, there's a roiling storm, the clouds as black as ink. But we're still in the sun. One touches me. In this place, I can feel it. I reach out and touch her, too. We're shoulder to shoulder, staring forward at the approaching storm. We got what we came for, she says. It's time for me to go. I turn to her. What is she saying? She bites her lip, looking at me apologetically. You realize this was never about saving my life, right? My heart sinks into my stomach, but I don't know why. Of course it was, I say. You think I came back and faced my family, went through all that for no reason? I was trying to save you. There was never any way to save me. A part of you knew that. I don't understand. We need to help the guard. She looks away from me, like this is as hard for her to say as it is for me to hear. But after your defeat at Ivan's hands, you felt you had nothing to offer the cause. You said you were too weak, too skinny, that you weren't the hero I am, that you didn't have any power. But now, you do. Her legacy, she's given it to me? I get to keep it? I'm sorry for tricking you, Adam, but you needed to get this point. If you hadn't come back here, a part of you still would have been attached to your family, to your people. You've seen how little they value you, how little they value anything but bloodshed and war. Now you're ready to walk with the guard, to truly fight against your own people. No. I pull away, my mind reeling. Please, Adam, use my legacy well. Across the sea, shadows dance and crackle and writhe in the clouds. Out there, I can see her moving in slow-motion combat, her last seconds playing out in front of us. One, I plead, please stop. This is how it has to be. Deep down, you knew it all along. Adam, I'm not real. I was never real. She turns to the roiling storm, to the tragic movie of her death playing in the clouds. The blade of some faceless Mogadorian sword penetrates her through her back, erupting from her stomach. The killing blow. Deep down you knew. I've been dead this whole time. I look at one. She's my best friend. She's everything to me. She turns from the scene of her death to look at me. You created me. Made me out of my memories, so you wouldn't have to walk this path alone. That's not possible. You're all I have. She smiles. No. You have you. The courage it took to turn against your people. The courage it took to come back here. To risk your life to get the power you'd need to walk a hero's path. That was always all you. One has never spoken so highly of me. I should be flattered, but all I am is scared. I'm going to lose her. I can't be alone. I feel pathetic, exposing my fears and weakness so totally to one. But I'm desperate. I've lost too much already to lose her, too. Adam, the alone part is over. I promise you. One, I say, my eyes filling with tears. I love you. She nods, smiling, then reaches forward to touch my cheek. She's crying now, too. If I'd lived, I think, she says, I think you really would have. She kisses me and says goodbye. And then she's gone forever. Chapter 12. There's a shape in the dark, moving around me. I see the sky, stars above. The shape is moving my limbs, resting my head on a soft mound of earth, pouring water over my wounds, forcing me to drink. The shape's skin is as white as the moon. Malcolm, I say.
Yes,
he says. He laughs, crouching beside me.
I'm Malcolm. I remember that now.
I sit up, half expecting to find myself still trapped in the lab, despite the sky, despite the stars. But we're in the wilderness, in a field, at the edge of a forest.
I carried you as far as I could. Then I needed to rest.
He sighs, taking a sip of water.
But we have to keep moving soon.
I'm baffled, utterly confused. How did we escape? Malcolm senses my confusion.
I woke up in the lab. Mogadorians were at the doors, trying to break in. That doctor was on the floor, and you were convulsing, and then, just as the Mogadorians came through the door, there was...
He trails off, laughing with amazement.
There was an earthquake.
As soon as I regain my strength, we begin to make our way on foot through forests, pastures, and farmland, traveling mostly at night to escape detection. We're headed west, trying to put as much space between us and what remains of Ashwood Estates as we can. Outside of Ashwood, with only the sky to measure time, days and nights pass without comment. I lose track of the hour, the day of the week, how long we've been on the road. 10 days? 12 days? I cease to measure time in numbers, counting instead the shifting landscapes, the changing scenery. Malcolm eventually explains that the earthquake seriously damaged the underground facilities. He says it was a miracle he was able to get us both out through the collapsing structure without being apprehended. He says it was as if the entire structure was collapsing around us, but never on us. Almost like it was creating an escape for us with every step he took. He figures the Mogs have their hands full rebuilding, that there's a good chance they haven't yet realized we even survived the devastation. But he thinks we need to keep moving to be safe. I agree. We've camped out for the day in an unused shed at the edge of a tobacco farm. My limbs are tired from our constant trekking, but my cuts and scrapes are starting to heal. Malcolm sees me mopping down the worst of my remaining cuts.
It's a miracle you weren't hurt worse.
He shakes his head in wonderment.
It's a miracle we weren't both killed. And it's an even bigger miracle the earthquake happened in the first place. If not, there would have been no escape.
Now's as good a time as any to tell him. It was no miracle. He stops what he's doing, looks at me curiously. I haven't used One's legacy on my own since the day I used it to destroy the Mogadorian lab. But I know the ability is still inside me. I can feel it there, nestled, pulsing, waiting for me to pick it up, to play. I close my eyes and concentrate. The ground beneath us heaves and ripples. The walls of the shed quake. A few rusted tools, hung by hooks, clatter off the wall to the ground. It's nothing major, barely a tremor. I only wanted to test myself and to show Malcolm my gift. Malcolm's stunned, eyes bulging.
That was amazing.
It's a legacy, a gift from the Lorik. Malcolm looks at me with one of his befuddled expressions. Do you know about the Lorik? I ask. I still don't really know what Malcolm remembers, how much is left of his brain.
I know a little, he says. My memory, it has patches.
He sighs heavily, clearly frustrated.
I've been working on it, trying to remember everything, but mostly I remember the darkness.
The darkness? I ask. But as soon as the words are out of my mouth, I realize what he means. The darkness of the containment pod. All those years in an induced coma, hooked up to machines, having his brain dredged for information. I shudder.
When I try to summon a memory, it's like I have to go back into the darkness to find it. I have to go back through years of nothing to remember any one thing.
He laughs, with a note of bitterness I've never heard in his voice before.
But there are a few things I remember that I don't have to fight to recall. Important things.
Malcolm goes quiet, lost in thought. Before I can press him to explain, he changes the subject.
You said you were given Alorik's power.
He leans forward.
So, you're not Alorik?
I grin. You thought I was Alorik? He nods.
Yeah, that or a high-priority human captive like me.
No, I say a bit nervously. I'm not human, and I'm not Alorik. I've been dreading telling him the truth. How will he react if he knows I belong to the same breed that held him in captivity and tortured him for years? But I knew I'd have to come clean eventually. I figure now's as good a time as any. I'm a Mogadorian. That befuddled look again.
If I'd known that, he says, I probably would have left you in the lab.
Uh-oh. But then he begins to laugh. Before I know it, I'm laughing too, and starting to tell him my story. Malcolm and I develop a routine, sleeping by day and walking by night. We graze farmland and forests and roadside dumpsters for sustenance. We cross hills, streams, and highways. We spend weeks, months, like this. I begin to lose track of time. When we're in remote fields, far from roads and houses, we train. Malcolm has no experience with legacies, but then neither do I. Brute force, with my newfound power, is no problem. I was able to nearly decimate Ashwood Estates, quite literally, in my sleep. But my precision and control need work, so we focus on that. In today's training session, Malcolm takes a position on the other side of a field. I stand, getting ready to wield my power. When we're both ready, we signal each other with our arms. Training time. I stare across the field at Malcolm, mentally mapping the distance between us. Malcolm has set pebbles on top of the fence posts, running the distance between us. For every pebble I knock off its post, he will deduct a few points. It's easy to send out my seismic force in an indiscriminate wave, knocking everything in its path, but he wants me to hit the area right beneath him, and only that area. He says this practice will increase my precision. I focus hard on where he is, until everything else disappears. Then I unleash my power. There are days when I can't even reach Malcolm, when the farthest I can send my power is 10 yards in front of me. There are other days when distance comes too easily, and I wildly overshoot, felling trees 50 yards past Malcolm's position. Sometimes I hit him with pinpoint accuracy, and the ground trembles delicately below him. When this happens, he calls out, telling me to sustain that gentle force. But sometimes the intensity of my seismic power slips outside of my control, and the ground will erupt beneath him, sending him 10 feet in the air. He's always patient, gracious, and kind about my misfires, which only makes me happier when I manage a perfect score at this game we've created, rumbling the earth immediately beneath his feet without sending him flying. It takes extraordinary control, and so much mental effort I usually wind up with a minor migraine, but it's worth it to see his proud face. My parents disowned me. I don't think my father ever loved me. I was never going to have the kind of unconditional love from a parent I saw on television or read about in human literature. During the 3 years I spent in One's mind, I saw her close relationship with Hilda, and I was jealous. They fought all the time, but on some deep level, they trusted and loved each other. Hilda trained and cultivated One's talents, encouraged her when she succeeded. Ever since I witnessed that, I craved something like it, a mentor. And now, I have one. One promised me I wouldn't be alone. She was right. Our route through the country becomes a zigzagging path, designed to escape Mogadorian detection. It's so roundabout that I never even consider we're heading somewhere specific, that Malcolm has a destination in mind. I enjoy the aimlessness. I feel safer off the grid, like I did back at the aid camp. But I know that eventually we're going to need a plan, some way to reconnect with the scattered guard. I may cringe at bloodshed, and I may fear that they will reject me for being a Mogadorian, but I can't help being excited by the prospect of meeting my new allies. After a long night's trek, we camp out in a small grove at the edge of the woods in rural Ohio. Malcolm devotes so much time and energy to training me that I've been repaying the favor, usually as we're settling down for a day's sleep. I train him. I ask him questions about his past, trying to jog his memory. I know his patchy memory is frustrating, but he will never recover his memories unless he works at it. So I grill him, pressing him for details. "What happened before the darkness?" I ask tonight. He's clearing some brush on the ground, making a smooth surface to sleep on.
"I hate this."
"I know," I say. "We're both exhausted, and mental training is the last thing either of us wants to do right now." But I keep going. "What happened before the darkness?"
"I'm tired," he says, stretching out on the dirt, "and I can't really remember."
"Come on, one thing," I say. "Just tell me one thing you remember from before the Mogs took you." He's quiet. "Malcolm, you already told me there's one important thing you remember from before. One thing you didn't even have to try to remember." I figure I can at least get that out of him. "Just tell me that." He turns to me suddenly serious.
"My son. I remember my son."
Whoa. I had no idea he had a son. The details of how I made contact with the Lorik, how I was captured by the Mogs, those things are starting to come back to me, though they're still fuzzy. But I remember everything about my life back in Paradise. He smiles. "I remember everything about Sam."
"Don't you want to see him?" I ask. "Of course I do. That's why I've been leading us back towards my old hometown."
He looks at me, clearly concerned about how I will react. I'm stunned. "That's where he is?"
"Well, I can't be sure he's still there, but it's my only guess. There's only a day or 2 days' trek from here."
I'm confused. I thought we were just running from the Mogadorians, but this whole time, Malcolm's been leading us to his home. But our path, it's been so random.
"I'm still trying to keep the Mogadorians off our tail. That we continue to evade detection is even more important the closer we get to Sam."
He sits up, giving me a solemn look.
"You don't have to come into town with me. It could be dangerous. For all I know, the Mogadorians are waiting for me there."
Malcolm looks at me, waiting to see how I will react. Under his gaze, I feel it. That familiar twinge of fear in my gut. My typical reluctance to enter the fray. But there's something different about me now. I have one's legacy. My legacy. I don't feel as powerless as I used to. If anything, I feel a strange itch to see what I can do with my new ability. Months ago, one tried to rouse me back to the Lorik cause, and I balked. It took her creating an epically complex psychological trick to get me to leave the aid camp. But I don't need much persuading from Malcolm. "Let's go," I say. Paradise, Ohio, is a classic small town. A harmonious blend of farmland and suburbia, a far cry from the tacky faux luxe of Ashwood's McMansions. Walking with Malcolm along the road leading through the town, sticking to the other side of the tree line to stay out of view, I take a deep breath. Yeah, I like it here. Just as Paradise's main drag comes into view down the road, Malcolm starts leading us away, deeper into the woods. We walk for a mile through the trees. We pass houses out here in the woods, some prosperous-looking farmhouses, some busted-down-looking shacks. We avoid all of them, beelining through the woods, to avoid being seen by anyone. "What's he like?" I ask. As we've been traveling, I've told Malcolm almost everything there is to know about me, about how the son of a respected Mogadorian leader came to be the traitor that I am now. But there's so much about Malcolm that's still a mystery to me. Sometimes I wonder if it's because he doesn't like to think about it himself. Still walking and staring straight ahead, Malcolm smiles sadly.
"I don't know," he says.
"You mean you can't remember?"
"No, not that. My memories of Sam haven't faded at all. It's just..."
He stops.
"I can't say what he's like now, not when I haven't seen him in all this time. I've missed everything. He was just a kid when I got taken. He was smart, and he was kind. A great kid."
He laughs.
"He was Sam."
"What happens when we find him?" I ask. Malcolm's expression darkens.
"I just need to see him. To know he's okay. You and I were marked for death by the Mogadorians. I know I can't exactly be a father to him under those conditions, but I need to see him at least once. After that,"
he says, his voice trailing off. I finish his thought. "After that, we go back on the run." Malcolm nods.
"It won't be safe for us to stick around."
I feel a strange twinge of relief at that thought.
"We're close," he says, quickening his stride.
I see a house up ahead, through the trees.
"That's it," he says.
As we walk, the texture of the dirt beneath our feet begins to shift. I look down. It's burned, scarred. My antennae go up, preparing for a possible attack. The closer we get, the worse it is. More scorched earth, more fallen trees. There's been a battle here. "Malcolm," I say, "the Mogadorians have been here." But of course, he's already noticed. He's speeding up, racing toward the house. I keep pace behind him, worried what we're running into. But when he runs up to the house's side door and bangs on it, and a shocked-looking woman steps outside, eyes bulging at Malcolm, I stop running. Malcolm's given me no instruction. I have no idea what's going on. I hang back. Malcolm holds the woman by the shoulders, talking to her, asking her questions. The woman's expression of shock and wonderment begins to melt, giving way to something else. Anger. She slaps him, then slaps him again. Soon she's unleashed a barrage, and Malcolm just stands there, absorbing each and every blow. I can't hear her from where I stand, but I know what she's saying. "Where were you? Where were you? Where were you?" She falls to her knees on the porch and begins to sob. Moments later, Malcolm joins her. I wait. Malcolm has been inside with the woman for an hour now. We exchanged a look before he headed inside with her. I nodded, giving him the sign that I'd be fine out here on my own. Kicking the scorched dirt, I'm anxious, keyed up. To judge by the tracks, by the burned patches of earth, there was some kind of conflict here not long ago. Mogadorians could be close. I have one's legacy now, I remind myself. Even if I come face to face with the Mog force, I'm not powerless anymore. I can fight back. The more time passes, the more I worry about Malcolm. To come all this way and discover that something has happened to his son would be devastating. Malcolm finally emerges from the house. He walks with a hard-nosed determination, strutting right past me and back into the woods. All he says is, "Come." I follow him across the backyard to a large stone well.
"It's open,"
he says, shaking his head. "So," I ask, "Malcolm, you have to tell me what's going on." Without answering, Malcolm climbs into the well and disappears. Again, I follow. I make my way down a long, narrow ladder and finally arrive at the bottom of the well. "Malcolm?" I ask. No response. I feel my way along the walls down a narrow passageway, which slowly gives way into a room. A large halogen lamp lights up, illuminating the space. Malcolm holds it and swings it around the room. I follow the arc of the beam, bare walls, some computer equipment in the corner, a shelf with supplies, water bottles, canned food. Startled by what I see, I gasp. Against the wall, close enough for me to touch, is a massive skeleton. The skeleton's head is tipped downwards in an angle of dignified, almost lordly resignation. But it's still a skull with deep, hollow sockets pointing right at me. I yelp, backing against the opposite wall.
"The Mogadorians didn't find this place," says Malcolm. "If they had, they wouldn't have left it like this. They would have destroyed this skeleton, or taken it. But the well was open. Someone's been here."
Malcolm resumes poking around in the chamber.
"The tablet's gone. He must have come here. And then after..."
"Malcolm," I whisper, hoping he will calm down and explain himself. "I'm in the dark here," I say. "Quite literally." He ignores my joke.
"My wife saw Sam with some other kids. She said there was a battle. By what she described, those other kids had to be members of the guard. Sam was with them, fighting by their side."
I experience a brief chill of excitement at the thought that the guard was here only a short time ago. The guard! My people! My new people!
"In my absence, I guess he took up my cause and wound up in battle with Moggs, and now he's gone."
Malcolm stares at me, a haunted look on his face.
"My son Sam is gone."
Malcolm's wife won't let him in the house again. She's too angry. As a result, we've camped out in his underground bunker, stretching out on the bare stone floor. I've slept in some pretty rough quarters since going on the run with Malcolm, but I've never faced a challenge quite like trying to fall asleep under the hollow nose of an 8-foot-tall skeleton. Malcolm explains that she is crushed by grief for her missing son, that as angry as she is with Malcolm for disappearing, the worst part is him finally reappearing only weeks after Sam disappeared, too late to save him. She blames Malcolm for whatever's happened to Sam, and Malcolm says she's right to blame him.
"It was my fault. I was so excited to make contact with the Lorik, I didn't even consider the consequences. Once I saw what the Mogadorians were capable of, I realized my role as a greeter might be a danger to my family. But it was too late. Before I could do anything to protect them, I was taken."
Malcolm theorizes that, haunted by his disappearance, Sam began to unravel some of the mysteries of the Mogadorian invasion, that he somehow forged an alliance with members of the guard, and that at some point in the past few weeks, in battle near his house, he was captured by the Moggs and either killed or detained. When Malcolm says this, my mind races back to the memo I encountered while snooping around the underground server in the media surveillance facility. The memo was already a year old when it declared all future detainees and captives were to be routed to the Dulce base in New Mexico. If Sam was captured weeks ago, there's a good chance he's being kept there. I stare at Malcolm, stretched out on the floor, his back to me. "Malcolm," I say. He rolls over and turns to me. I can see from his gaze that he's lost in doubt and guilt and grief. Clearly the search for his son is what's been driving him since we escaped from Ashwood. "I think I know where your son is,"